Using gerrymandering, voter suppression, and other nefarious tactics, the Republican Party has manipulated our electoral system to maintain as much control as possible despite being a party in the minority. Liberal Dan Radio seeks to change that, and I need your help in doing so. Liberal Dan Radio has partnered with Levelfield to help us use tools that are typically only available to big money donors. When you go to stopthecoup.liberaldan.com and make your contribution, it will encourage other voters to reach out to their legislators to pass legislation to stop gerrymandering and voter suppression, and target elected officials who refuse to protect the vote. Every eligible voter should be able to cast a ballot, and that ballot should have the same power as everyone else. I can't do this alone. I need your help. So please go to stopthecoup.liberaldan.com and make your contribution today. That's stopthecoup.liberaldan.com. stopthecoup.liberaldan.com. Political advertising paid for by Levelfield. Contributions are not tax deductible as charitable contributions. Join the conversation. It's area code 914-803-4131. That is 914-803-4131. If you are a Blog Talk Radio member, which is free, you can always go to the episode page, blogtalkradio.com/liberaldan. Go to the bottom of the screen once you're logged in, and you could join us in the chat room over there. And if you're watching live on YouTube, you could also make sure to subscribe to the channel. You don't have to join in and participate, but make sure to subscribe to the channel, and we can you can leave your comments, questions in the chat as well. And if you're listening after the live broadcast, you can always leave your comments, questions, concerns, etc. over on the show thread at liberaldan.com, at facebook.com/liberaldan, or at liberaldanradio on Twitter. Or if you're here on YouTube, you could always leave your comments on the YouTube comment section as well. We are not doing a bunch of the bits that we would normally do today because we do have a bunch of stuff to talk about, and nobody has sponsored a bit, so I don't have to worry about making sure to fulfill that part of my obligations. Obviously, I do want people to sponsor those bits, Hypocrite of the Week, Words of Redneck Wisdom, etc. So I'd be more than happy to have y'all sponsor those. But since, you know, we're not at that point yet, we will sometimes we skip a week or two on the bits just to see what's going on. Now, the next week, starting next week, there'll be a very special Liberal Dan Radio introduction to the show. And that start, if you've listened to the show before, you'll know that what is coming. And if not, it'll be holiday themed intro that I play, and you might even get early access to it if you sign up for the Liberal Dan Radio Patreon. So that's one of the best ways to support the show, is supporting the Patreon, patreon.com/liberaldan. You can also shouts out to Demonox, the first Liberal Dan Radio patron, and also to my good buddy Cesar out in California, and your boy Chris, who have all supported Liberal Dan Radio via the Patreon. But of course, if you can't afford a monthly payment, there's also the Buy Me a Coffee option or the Buy Me a Slider option at liberaldan.com. And there is also just subscribing here and to all of my other social media platforms. And that is another way to support the podcast and support the show and every new channel. So lots of stuff to talk about this week. Of course, Bringing a Boy is in the chat with us. Bringing a Boy is the first like. I see that there is a like, so I believe you. I would have believed you anyway, but it does show up as having one like on the podcast and two concurrent viewers, one of which I guess is me or my other account that I, basically monitor it with just in case, see what's going on. But, I appreciate you, Bringing a Boy. Welcome, and again, We're going to be talking a little bit about Rittenhouse because the Rittenhouse verdict took place after last week's podcast. So we're going to be talking a little bit about that. We'll be talking about the McMichaels and William Bryan and the verdicts in the Ahmaud Arbery killing case. So, you know, I was kind of hoping that it would come out today, that the ruling would be made by today. And of course it was. So there's that. And then we're going to be getting a little bit into affirmative defenses. I had a whole bunch of information up about affirmative defenses on my screens. And because my computer needed a mandatory, or there was some mandatory reboot that it had to do, I lost it all. So I'll just go back into the history, I guess, and see. But we'll catch that up during our commercial break. But that's the way things go, I guess. Plus, I'm also fighting a little bit of a bad back, so I haven't been feeling the best today, unfortunately. Fortunately, we have a four-day weekend, being a Turkey Day and all. Although, we do have, if you're local to New Orleans, I am hosting trivia at a local cidery, at Broad Street Cider, on Friday night. So if you happen to be in New Orleans and you want to join us for trivia, I will be the host, and it should be interesting trivia questions that I'll be asking. Normally I don't run the trivia, but I did want to run it at least once just to figure it would be fun. And well, I came up with some interesting questions. So that'll be fun. And you know, if it don't have a lot of turnout because it's Black Friday, well,
it is what it is.
Thank you, Donald. Anyway, so, but anyway, Kyle Rittenhouse obviously found not guilty of all the charges. I think one of the most disgusting things that I saw was the outside of that is the fact that, you know, Stephen Crowder, the Louder with Crowder, they did a live stream and they're all like, yeah, like their winning team just scored a touchdown or something, or won the Super Bowl. Like it affects their lives, you know, greatly, because this kid got off with, you know, killing these people. And again, I predicted here on the podcast, despite the fact that I disagree with the ruling, I did predict that he would be not guilty with almost everything. I posted that before the show. And I also believe that you know, if he was guilty of the weapons charge, which eventually got tossed after I made that video that Monday, I figured that would have been overturned on appeal anyway. So it wasn't a big surprise that Rittenhouse was not convicted. Of course, other individuals, you know, we had, you know, one of the people who believed Kyle Rittenhouse to be factually innocent, he disagreed with me. He felt that they would have been, that he was going to be, ruled guilty, and he didn't trust the justice system to bring justice, if you will. For some reason, my YouTube stream is not showing any data, although my there we go, Ripley. Crowder celebrated because people like you were so hell-bent and villainized Kyle. Ripley, can you hear me right now? Because YouTube is kind of showing that I'm not putting any data up, and I seem to be having a technical glitch. What? All right, let's go back and go live. Let's go live again. Let's stop streaming. We'll start streaming again. Because this is the first time I've had a technical to give to. If you're listening on Blog Talk Radio, you'll still hear me. I'm assuming you're still hearing me because it's showing. Come on. There we go. Start streaming. Let's see if it works now. Let's see. Come on. Let's restart OBS. Emphasis on the BS. Launch anyway. Come on. Now let's try. There we go. And we're live again. Yay. All right. We are back. And hopefully we'll continue to be able to have a show and not have YouTube not want to see that, you know, we don't have bits coming. I don't know what happened there, but we are back again live on YouTube. We were, I guess, shockingly enough, it wasn't Blog Talk Radio that was the glitchy thing. It was YouTube that was the glitchy thing. That never happens. It's very weird. So let's see. Let's exit back out. Go here. Plop back over here. There we go. All right. So hopefully the people will find, you know, hopefully Bringing a Boy. Bringing a Boy looks like he's still on the chat. He's still listening on the chat on Blog Talk Radio. So hopefully he'll be able to, he'll join back in on YouTube as well. Anyway, but we'll go back to discussing. I guess we'll start over. Rittenhouse, you know, Steven Crowder was cheering and whatever. There we go. There's Ripley's back. So Ripley found his way there. You know, and we were talking about, you know, right before I got cut off by YouTube, Crowder and how he was cheering. And Ripley said that Crowder was cheering because of how people like us villainized Rittenhouse. And I mean, when you view somebody as the villain of the story, I mean, I guess it's kind of hard to not villainize him. I mean, I think that, you know, I disagree with the ruling. I knew it was coming because Binger was a terrible prosecutor. He made some clear stumbles, some clear problems that he had in prosecuting the case. Several times when he just completely misspoke, and I'm like, what are you doing? And then sometimes when he just completely just butted up against the judge when judge clearly told him, hey, you know, you're not supposed to talk about this, and he still talked about it, and then he tried to play dumb. So what are you typing, Ripley? I don't understand what that means. ALDTOCABM, what? But so I wasn't surprised again that Rittenhouse was deemed to be not guilty. And of course what the non guilty meeting means, I mean, yes, the state has to consider him to be innocent because it is innocent until proven guilty, and he wasn't proven guilty in the court. But all the ruling basically said is that the prosecution didn't prove its case. So it didn't necessarily justify what Rittenhouse did. It just says that the prosecution didn't prove the case. And of course, and we'll get later in the show, we're going to be talking about the idea of affirmative defenses, where they still exist, and where I believe the state of Wisconsin and the other states have gone wrong with altering how we handle affirmative defenses, because in doing so, we handcuff the prosecution too much. Now, there's some people would say, well, you have the presumption of innocence. Well, yes, but there could be a presumption of innocence, generally speaking, while we also maintain the idea that, you know, nobody should be forced to prove a negative. And we'll get to that later. And we'll get to examples of that later, both in federal law and in other examples of law where, you know, you might be able to use it. So you guys will never admit. No, so here's the thing, and that's not true, Ripley. Says you guys will never admit you were wrong in the first sentence. And there are many a times when I've admitted that I'm wrong. Will I admit that I'm wrong on my opinion of Rittenhouse? No, because it's my opinion. You know, I don't believe that what he did was reasonable, and I have yet to see an argument to say that it was reasonable. And all that happened in the trial was the prosecution failed to show that it wasn't not reasonable, like they had to, because of how the state laws are written, he had to prove that it wasn't reasonable in order to get the conviction. And that's a much more difficult task than you might have on a normal typical crime or whatever. Would you like to come to Ohio and I'll run you through some sim encounters? I have gone through sim encounters, Ripley. I've been years ago. I went into I was taking a police academy, Citizens Police Academy course, where they took the people and then they through all parts of policing. Got to ride in the police car. Got to have conversations with individuals who did various parts of law enforcement, and one of the things that we did in the class was we went through a simulator. And I know, Ripley, I know you explained why you believe it was reasonable many times. I'm just saying I don't agree with your opinion. But in those simulations, like they'll tell, at least the ones that the police officers had, it basically said when you used force, like when I shot, and how soon before deadly force was allowed was your shot. And each time I got it in like less than a second after when deadly force was allowed. And there were people who like shot like seconds early, you know, 10, 15 seconds early. And I shot, you know, exactly pretty much almost dead on accurately as to when deadly force would have been allowed. There was never a simulation that I went through that I didn't use deadly force properly, nor was there a simulation where I was shot, because I accurately and accurately and adequately responded to the threat as simulated. Of course, the simulated threat can't necessarily be the same thing as the real one. It does get your heart racing a little bit. You know, you do get a little bit into the moment, but it can never, and I know it can never replace the real thing. But yeah, I've been through those simulations. I've been through them. I've seen them. I've also, you know, in those simulations, before we went through the simulations, the police officer sat us down and were very specific about, you know, escalation and when deadly force can be used and when deadly force can't be used. So, you know, and so based off of that and that information that police officers gave me, that's part of what I base my decisions when I look at these other cases and see, okay, here's an example of somebody who used deadly force too soon. And there are always going to be people who are like, well, you know, better judged by 12 than buried by 6 or carried by 6 or whatever. And I just don't believe that to be a reasonable thing. You know, it, to them, it's better to shoot too early than to not shoot at all. To me, you need to use the reasonable amount of force that is justified. And not once during that whole thing, you know, do I believe that they would have said that shooting at the point where no contact had been made would have been a reasonable thing to do. The sims we do are very different. I'm willing to pay for your travel expenses. Ooh. Ugh. We will think about that one. You know, I'll consider that offer, Ripley. I'm not traveling anywhere until all of my children are fully vaccinated. So that's first of all. But if you're serious about that, we can talk about it. I have some travel issues that I have to deal with, you know, because of my size. I'm a big guy, so flying sometimes isn't the easiest thing to do. But we'll see. I'll let you know. And you can email me. It's liberaldanradio@gmail.com. So that's my email address. So if you want to email, you can. We can figure it out another way, and we'll talk about it. Anyway, let's go ahead and take the first commercial break. We'll come back, take your calls as well. 914-803-4131. That is 914-803-4131. This is Liberal Dan Radio. Talk from the left. That's right. Are you planning a trip to Disney soon? Do you want help avoiding spending mistakes and making the most of your vacation? Then check out Budgeteers.com, a new site devoted to helping you get the most mouse for your money. What kind of tickets should you get? Is the dining plan a good deal for you? Should you stay on grounds or not? Should you buy park hoppers? Many other sites are filled with information about what other people like to do, but Budgeteers is geared to help you make the best decision for you. So check out Budgeteers.com or go to YouTube.com/Budgeteers and help make your trip the best it can be. Budgeteers.com is not a travel agency and it is not affiliated with the Disney Corporation or any of its holdings. In a world gone mad, one progressive will do a bad movie trailer guy impression to get you to listen to his show. There's only one thing that I like better than the Liberal Dan Radio minicast.
All right, Bill, that's enough of that. On the Liberal Dan Radio minicast, you will hear an honest discussion of the day's issues, with some personal bits in between. You might even hear what the other side has to say, sometimes even in their own voices. So become one of the Liberal Dan family, because family means no one gets left behind or forgotten.
To hear those bad impressions and more, tune into the Liberal Dan Radio minicast. Talk from the left, that's right.
And I think to myself, what a wonderful show.
If you enjoy Liberal Dan Radio, there's many ways that you can support the show. You can subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can like me on Facebook or follow me on Twitter or TikTok. And you can become a Liberal Dan Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, you can get a shout out. Higher levels get the opportunity to vote on what I do next on the podcast, the minicast, or on YouTube. You can even buy commercial advertising or sponsor bits. So go to patreon.liberaldan.com and support the show today.
Hey there, podcast listeners. This is Deminox, host of The World According to Knox. It's time for Season 2, where I take you on another trip through my world. The world of movies, video games, pop culture, and more. Relate them to the world around you. Don't forget to leave a question for MarsCat and find me on Twitter by the handle XDeminox. That's letter X like X-Men, D-E-M-I-N-O-X. Now enjoy the rest of your podcast.
Welcome back to Liberal Dan Radio, Talk from the Left, that's right. This is your host, Dan Zimmerman, coming at you from New Orleans, Louisiana. To join the conversation, it's area code 914-803-4131. That's 914-803-4131. And since we did have to restart the live stream over on YouTube, I do want to again remind everybody to thank you to Deminox for being the first Liberal Dan Radio patron. World According to Knox is his podcast. I want to also shout out to Cesar and to your boy Chris for both supporting the Patreon as well. Finally, shout out to my little brother, the host of the Most Nimbus Yosh with the Percy podcast. You could always listen to the smooth sounds of the Percy podcast by going to his podcast at Percy Podcast, or at the Percy Podcast, I think it is, on Twitter. So you can check that out. I don't think he's made a new one recently, but he has some oldies and goodies up there. And they're always supportive of the podcast, so I like to be supportive of them. So we talked Rittenhouse. We've talked about Rittenhouse a lot. I did want to just kind of go over, you know, the fact that it would be remiss if I didn't talk about it since the verdicts were read after last week's podcast. But today's verdicts were in the cases of the McMichaels, Travis McMichael, Greg McMichael, and William Bryan. Were all found guilty of at least six of the charges. And in Travis McMichael's case, he was found guilty in all nine charges. Now, I thought it was nine charges total for all three of them. But no, it's nine charges. It was nine charges for each of them. And so for those people who don't understand what happened, or why the Georgia's law seems to be kind of weirdly written. So you have the charge of malice murder, which basically it doesn't need any additional felony of them in and of itself. It just needs the person to do it with either explicit or implicit malice. If you kill somebody with explicit or implicit malice, you can be charged and can be convicted of malice murder. Now, felony murder, which to me is a weird name because all murder is, should be a felony. If it's not a felony, it's misdemeanor or, you know, so it's all, I think manslaughter should potentially be a, I don't know, but all murder should be a felony. But this basically felony murder is you committed a felony, and in committing that felony, you then caused somebody to die. So in order to be convicted of felony murder, somebody has to die while you're committing a felony. So you have to be you have to be convicted of the felony before you can be convicted of the murder. And so the way it works is that, let's say you have four felonies, that they were each charged with four felonies that were, you know, not murders. The felony with a gun, you know, aggravated assault with the deadly weapon with a gun, aggravated assault with the deadly weapon with the cars, the trucks. You had the false imprisonment. Then you had the commission to, or the attempt to commit a felony, just the kind of more generic charge. So all four charges. So instead of basically saying, and I guess the law says that if your law kid doesn't say, if you know, here's a felony murder charge, it doesn't allow you to do, if any of these four you're convicted on, you can then charge with the felonies. It's not like all four attached to one. So you have to basically then say, okay, so this is a felony, or this is a felony, and this is felony murder. Then this is the second felony, and that's the second felony murder that goes along with that felony. So each felony murder has to go with an individual felony charge, which is why, you know, since Brian didn't have a gun, he didn't get found guilty of the felony of aggravated assault with a gun. As such, he can't be found guilty of the felony murder based off of that charge, which is why, you know, he didn't get charged with that. But Gregory McMichael was possessing a gun, and as such, he was able to be found guilty of the aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, just threatening somebody with a gun. So because it was tightly coupled, so to speak, with the death of Ahmaud Arbery, and as such, Greg McMichael was able to be, you know, convicted on that first felony murder charge. And the second, because, you know, they were in the truck, and the third because of false imprisonment, and the fourth because of the commission of the, you know, committing an act or attempting to commit a felony or whatever, which is the fourth charge. So, but they only ruled that Travis McMichael, who was the one who fired the gun, was the one who acted with malice. So he gets the malice murder charge, and he gets the malice murder conviction, because Greg didn't shoot his weapon to kill. That meant that he only got those eight. He got all four felonies and all four felony murders attached to all those felonies. But because, again, Brian didn't have the gun, he couldn't then get charged on the felony murder with the deadly weapon with the gun, but he got the other three because he involved himself by trying to, you know, block in Arbery, by trying to box him in using his own vehicle. So he got that one plus the unlawful imprisonment, plus the fourth felony as well. So that's why he got the six, the three felonies plus the three murders attached to it. But my understanding of it is that if you, and once this goes to sentencing, that it's, they're all going to roll up. Like, so if you get, so I don't know if the malice murder rolls up as well, or if that's a separate charge that stays separate, but all of those felony murders, if you got two, or three, if you got three or four, all of those kind of roll up into one. So they got him on felony murder. The sentencing will all kind of combine on that. So you're not going to have like four possible sentences of felony murder for Greg McMichael, and three possible felony murder charges with three possible different sentences for Brian. That's not how it works. They're all going to roll up into one, and then they're going to be sentenced based off of that one felony murder. That's how that works. it seems weird. It's a little confusing. Perhaps they could have done it more easily to say, hey, these are the felony murders. These are the felonies that we're charging you with. And if you get convicted on any one of those, then you could get charged with a felony murder charge. And that would seem to be reasonable, but I guess you got to give people need to give their lawyers pay. The lawyers need to get their pay, I suppose. So that's how it works. And I think the sentencing is going to take place on different days for each of the different defendants or the convicted people, I guess is the more appropriate say, because they all are convicted murderers at this point. Plus, you're going to have appeals that are going to be attempted. I don't know how you appeal. I don't know how, I don't know on what basis they're going to appeal. I mean, in my opinion, the defense is always going to have to try and defend their clients to the best of their ability. Some of the arguments made by these defense lawyers were just terrible, trying to nab one of the jurors, hoping that one juror would be just racist enough. Plus you had all of we want a mistrial because there are people protesting outside. We want a mistrial because there are preachers in the courtroom. Why does having preachers in the courtroom have anything to do with anything? Are the preachers in the courtroom misbehaving? I mean, his father, Arbery's father, Mr. Arbery, did cheer a little bit when the first ruling was given for the malice murder charge of Travis McMichael, and he was then yeeted from the courtroom. So there's that. But I mean, he heard the one that he needed to hear, and then he just allowed himself to just be kicked out of the courtroom. At which point we heard the rest of the verdict. I can't necessarily blame him, though, and I don't know if I would have been able to restrain myself. I know the mom cried, but not audibly enough to cause her to be removed from the courtroom as well. So, but one of the things with this case is that it's so bizarre. This case is so bizarre in that the only reason that we have this case and that we have a conviction in this case is the fact that they turned over the tape. Greg McMichael was the one who was like, hey, give this DJ, this radio DJ, the tape of what happened that night. Because people were trying to say that they were, flying Confederate flags and chasing down. They believed that this tape would have got them, to say, hey, nothing these boys did were bad. They were just being good citizens. They believed that this video exonerated them, that it was, as some people say, exculpatory evidence. They believed that this was going to exonerate them. They thought that it was going to make them look better. They thought that this is going to help them be free and clear of the charges. That's just bizarre that, A, don't record yourself when you're in the middle of lynching somebody. B, don't, if you have the tape recording, don't turn it over willingly. That's just dumb. It's just not wise to do that. I've said on the show before, if you're ever in a position where don't make the cops or the people investigating you's job any easier than it has to be. They have a job to do. You're under no requirement to do it. You're under no requirement to help them unless they give you a warrant. Then, of course, they have to have the warrant to be able to find whatever they want to find. But you're not required to help them. They basically just buried their own proverbial grave, at least. They gave them the evidence up, and then that evidence got released to the general public. And the general public was like, what the hell is this? This person was lynched, and they recorded it. They lynched him, and it was recorded. And that's why they're going to jail. And the judge now gets to determine, the minimum sentence for felony murder or for malice murder is life. Now, the judge can determine whether or not that life sentence it can come with parole or without parole. But even if it comes with parole, even if parole is allowed, they have to serve 30 years. So Greg McMichael's 65-ish, so he'll be in jail. I guess maybe he'll get time served, so that'll be 29 years that he would be eligible for parole, so but basically 30. He won't be able to get out of jail till 95. Do you think he's leaving prison outside of a wooden box? No. William Bryan, he is 50-something, so he'll be over 80 when he would be potential for parole, if parole is even allowed. There's no guarantee that parole will be allowed in either of these cases or any of these cases. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. Who knows? We'll find out later. If I had to bet, if any of them won't get parole, it would probably be Travis McMichael, because I think it would be odd to make the malice murder person be eligible for parole. But even if he's eligible, he's what, 35-ish? Maybe a little older now? So he wouldn't be able to get out until 65? I mean, odds of them, any of them making it out of prison alive. And then that's parole. Then you would have to say, are you eligible? Should these people be paroled? And what are the odds that these people are going to be able to be paroled? I mean, people's memories can be short, but I just don't see it. I just don't see the memories I don't see them getting out of jail outside of a pine box. It just doesn't make any sense to me that they would. But anyway, I mean, I'm very glad that they reached this ruling. I think the ruling was clear and obvious. And there were people who both believed that Rittenhouse is factually innocent and who also believed that the McMichaels and Bryan were factually innocent. They should be fitted for their Klan robes. Daily News says life sentence is a life sentence. Life, that's it. That's not necessarily true. You can get parole. If he can, the judge can opt to give parole or not. Whether or not to allow the potential of a parole. But again, you still, under Georgia law, you still have to serve 30 years before they can even consider paroling you. So basically it will be a life sentence. And I don't see them offering Travis McMichael the opportunity for parole. Even if they give Greg McMichael the opportunity to parole, 95, lasting to 95 in a prison cell, I don't think that's possible. And who knows, 80 years old for Bryan. Again, even if he had the opportunity for parole, I don't see him lasting 30 years in prison. It just doesn't seem to be reasonable. So, but it's good that the verdicts came down the way that they did. It's good that, you know, some people don't say it's justice. Some people just say that this is the repercussions, and that true justice comes in other forms. You know, they will receive justice for their actions that they did, but there's no way for Ahmaud Arbery to get real justice because he can't be around to appreciate it because he's dead. And I'll just be honest, some of the things that were said by the people like Carl Sharpton and everything outside, I don't know if I'd be able to sit there and be able to, you know, say something like, you know, oh, well, God used Arbery as a, you know, as a tool or whatever. But like, I wouldn't want to think that any deity had any responsibility in the fact that my child died. So I would have a hard time squaring that circle, so to speak. I would have a hard time, you know, agreeing with that. Anyway, let's go ahead and take the second commercial break. And again, we'll come back. We'll talk about affirmative defenses. And if you want, taking your calls as well, 914-803-4131. That's 914-803-4131. This is Liberal Dan Radio. Talk from the left. That's right.
Greetings. This is Nimbus Yosh, host of the Percy Podcast. What is the Percy Podcast? Well, it's pretty much the smoothest talking host you'll ever hear in your life, talking about all kinds of things. Political things, nerdy things, fun things, not so fun things. Go ahead, give a listen, and follow at the Percy Podcast for more updates and information. Why not sit back and take a listen to one of the best podcasts you'll ever hear, and no one else will. Catch you on the tunes.
Do you want to set money aside for a rainy day? Do you want to open an account that will give you a savings bonus each month? What if I told you that you can get both and have a chance to win $10 million? YADA is an FDIC-insured bank, and when you go to yada.liberaldan.com, open an account, and make your first deposit, you will get 100 entries into the next weekly drawing. You will also get entries each week you have a balance. So go to yada.liberaldan.com. That's yotta.liberaldan.com.
Using gerrymandering, voter suppression, and other nefarious tactics, the Republican Party has manipulated our electoral system to maintain as much control as possible despite being a party in the minority. Liberal Dan Radio seeks to change that, and I need your help in doing so. Liberal Dan Radio has partnered with Levelfield to help us use tools that are typically only available to big money donors. When you go to stopthecoup.liberaldan.com and make your contribution, it will encourage other voters to reach out to their legislators to pass legislation to stop gerrymandering and voter suppression, and target elected officials who refuse to protect the vote. Every eligible voter should be able to cast a ballot, and that ballot should have the same power as everyone else. I can't do this alone. I need your help. So please go to stopthecoup.liberaldan.com and make your contribution today. That's stopthecoup.liberaldan.com. stopthecoup.liberaldan.com. Political advertising paid for by Levelfield. Contributions are not tax deductible as charitable contributions.
And welcome back to Liberal Dan Radio, Talk from the Left. That's right. This is your host, Dan Zimmerman, coming at you from New Orleans, Louisiana. Again, to join the conversation, it's 914-803-4131. That is 914-803-4131. We are live here on Blog Talk Radio and on YouTube, and you can join us, and you can leave comments and questions in the chat as well. One of my issues that I've had during both, I mean, despite the fact that Georgia and Wisconsin both have laws that basically require the prosecution to disprove the affirmative defenses. So, you know, in Georgia, just as much as Wisconsin, you have, you know, if somebody raises an affirmative defense, it is the responsibility of the prosecution to say that the affirmative defense is not valid, i.e. prove the negative. And that's not always how affirmative defenses have been. Affirmative defenses have been done in ways like, for example, let's say I am accused of stealing an item from you. Let's say I have a watch that you owned, right? And you used to own this watch, and I now have possession of it. Now you're trying to claim that I stole this watch from you, and you show, hey, this is a picture of me wearing this watch, and these are the markings on the watch that prove that the watch belonged to me, and so therefore you need to go arrest Dan for stealing my watch and return my property to me as well. So the police come knocking at the door, and they bring me to court, and we have a criminal case over theft of your watch. Now, let's say normally they would have to prove somehow that I had the watch. They can't prove that I had the watch, or they can't show evidence that I walked off with the watch in my possession from their property. Then the onus is on the prosecution to prove that I stole the watch. However, let's say I did have possession of the watch. Let's say that I had agreed to buy the watch from you. for a certain amount of money. Let's say I was like, okay, I'll buy the Hirachi. I'll buy this watch for you for $200. We sign up a contract. You agree to it. You know, maybe I've even put the sale on video. Say, hey, you're agreeing to sign this watch for me. So I could then go in court, say, assuming it made it to court. I could go to the court and say, hey, yes, I have his watch. This is the watch that used to belong to him. But he sold it to me, so I have proof that this watch is now my property. So that is what an affirmative defense should be like. I then show the signatures on the contracts. I say, hey, here is the contract that I bought the item from him. Here's the bill of sale. Here's a video of me buying the watch and him agreeing. Here's the email conversations that we have negotiating the price of the watch and then coming to an agreement to purchase the watch. And here's the canceled check. On the bottom of the canceled check, I wrote watch on it. So here's all of the evidence. I have now proven that I legally bought this item. So that is an affirmative defense. Now, to argue that the prosecution in this case should have had to prove that I didn't steal it. You know, had to prove that I really did steal it, that I had to disprove a negative. Like, how could they do that? If I say, he sold it to me, how could the prosecution prove that they didn't sell it to me? If the person who's making the accusation that I stole the watch doesn't have evidence of me stealing the watch, how are they going to prove, how is it at all reasonable to say, okay, here's Dan. He's claiming that he didn't steal the watch because it was sold, and that's his affirmative defense. It was a sale and it wasn't a theft. It's unreasonable to say the prosecution has to prove that it's not a, has to prove that I'm wrong, has to prove that I didn't buy it. No, the prosecution shouldn't have to do that. If I'm saying, hey, I have this watch and this is it, the owner should be on me, the defendant, making the claim that there was a sale to provide the evidence of the sale. And once I provide evidence of the sale, then that should be enough to acquit me. Now, and that's not taking away my presumption of innocence. That's me saying, here's the evidence that I have. And I'm raising the affirmative defense, and here's the evidence that I have. Now, the Daily News says, this is your interpretation of how the law works, which is your opinion on how you see the law is written. Well, I'm going to get to that in a second, bringing a boy. Or is this the lovely wife, because it's not in all caps. Take for another example. What is another affirmative defense? Another affirmative defense is insanity. I am not guilty by the reason of insanity. So if I raise the affirmative defense, not guilty by reason of insanity, does now the prosecution have to prove that I'm not insane? No. If I declare an affirmative defense of not guilty by reason of insanity, it is the responsibility of the defense to bring evidence that I am not sane, to bring expert witnesses that will testify to my mental state, to be able to say he was not in his right mind during this portion of time, or he's just not generally in his right mind, so therefore he is not guilty of committing the crime because of his mental issues. So it is not reasonable to say that the prosecution should in that case, because of the presumption of innocence, have to prove, it shouldn't just be accepted as the fact as, oh, well, he says that he's insane, so we're going to believe that he's insane so that he can get away with it. And then the prosecution has to prove that I'm not insane. Now, prosecution may be able to call another expert witness to be able to try and counteract the testimony that's given to try and claim that I was insane during whatever commission of whatever crime that I did. But still, the responsibility is on me and my defense team to prove that argument, because we've raised an affirmative defense. What are you saying yes to? That's correct. Are you agreeing with that one? Okay, so let's go to. We are looking at. I'm looking at federal criminal defense outline. Assistant federal public defender Angela Saad, Western District of Texas. So this is from. This is from a government website talking about all the different types of defenses that you might have. so let's go scroll down to page 18, which is a list of affirmative defenses. Now, this is affirmative defenses in federal law. And affirmative defenses, yes, it's the job of the prosecutor to rebut. Still, in order for the court to prove to the court that I am insane, it's not enough for me to say I'm insane. It's not enough for the defense attorney to say I'm insane. Defense attorneys raise the affirmative defense of insanity, not guilty, for reasons of insanity, and then have to present evidence to support that fact. Okay, so let's go to the affirmative defenses under federal criminal processes. So the first affirmative defense listed in this document is duress. So duress was said to excuse criminal conduct where the actor was under an unlawful threat of imminent death or serious bodily injury, which threat caused the actor to engage in conduct violating the literal terms of criminal law. So let's say somebody has a gun to one of my family members' heads and they say, go steal this item for me from a store and come back to me. And if you do that, I'll let you and your family go. That's duress, okay? The defense of duress does not negate a defendant's criminal state of mind when the defense requires the defendant to have acted knowingly or willfully. Instead, it allows the defendant to hold liability because coercive conditions or necessity negates the conclusion of guilt, even though the necessary mens rea was present. So to succeed, this is from this paperwork. To succeed on a duress defense, the defendant must show that the defendant or a member of his family was under an unlawful and present imminent and impending threat of such nature as to induce a well-grounded apprehension of death or serious bodily injury. Two, that he did not recklessly or negligently place himself in a situation in which it was probable that he would be forced to choose a criminal conduct. And three, that he had no reasonable legal alternative to violating the law. That is, that he had no chance to refuse to do the criminal act and avoid the threatened harm. And four, that there was a direct causal relationship between the criminal action taken and the avoidance of the threatened harm. So, and the burden of proof is on the defendant in federal cases. The defendant bears the burden of proving duress by preponderance of the evidence. So, if you were trying to convict me of a crime, you know, the prosecution still has to prove that I did it. However, if I am going to claim that I was under duress, I can't just say I'm under duress and then have the prosecution then be forced to prove that I wasn't under duress. No, under federal law, I have the responsibility as the defendant, or the defense attorneys have the responsibility to prove with a preponderance standard. So it's not beyond reasonable doubt, but it's just more likely than not that I was under duress, that I met those four qualifications that are required for being considered under duress, so that I don't have to face criminal punishment for the criminal acts that I did, because I'm admitting that I did the criminal acts. I'm admitting that I did these acts that are normally considered a crime. I'm just saying to the court that I shouldn't be punished for them, because under the law, if I'm doing it under duress, I am not responsible for legally doing those actions because somebody else was forcing me to. Again, there was no requirement. This didn't get around. This doesn't eliminate my preponderance of. It doesn't eliminate the assumption of innocence, but it does require that I do have to now prove my argument in my affirmative defense. Let's see. You say the court has the right to say if you're insane. The court has the right to say if I'm insane, but the court needs to be given evidence to show that I'm insane, if we're talking about the insanity affirmative defense. and the responsibility on proving that one is insane rests on the defense to provide a witness to say, yes, this person was insane. Okay. Let's see. Evidence, trial considerations, evidence in support of duress defense must show that the person of ordinary firmness would succumb to the level of coercion present in a given set of circumstances. In addition, evidence supporting the defendant's state of mind or to bolster the defendant's credibility can be admissible despite hearsay and relevancy objections. Where duress is raised, even if a defendant does not testify, evidence of a prior conviction can be admitted to prove the defendant's criminal intent. And there are jury instructions about that. In sentencing, I think the defendant can argue for a downward departure under U.S. sentencing or a variance under whatever based on imperfect duress defense. At sentencing, the district court may consider subjective factors demonstrating duress, but not to determine criminal liability. All right, we're going to skip necessity because there's some odds there. All right, self-defense. Federal self-defense. If you're claiming self-defense in a federal court, self-defense is available when a defendant acts criminally in order to protect himself from a real or threatened attack. Like the elements of duress, the elements of self-defense are defendant was under unlawful and present imminent impending threat, that he has not recklessly or negligently placed himself in a situation where it was probable that he would be forced to choose the criminal conduct. He had no reasonable or legal alternative, and there is a direct causal relationship. The burden of proof in this, the defendant has the burden of production, but not proof when asserting self-defense. And so I'd never heard the term burden of production. So what did I do? I went and looked up burden of production. A party's obligation to come forward with sufficient evidence to support a particular proposition of fact. Satisfying the burden of production may also be referred to as establishing a prima facie claim. Determining whether a party has satisfied its burden of production is not an issue of fact for the jury. It is an issue of law. When a party has satisfied its burden of production, it has produced enough evidence on an issue to have the issue decided by the fact finder rather than decided against the party in a directed verdict, motion for judgment, or motion for summary judgment, also referred to as a burden of going forward with the evidence. Production burden. And so a prima facie case is Latin for at first sight. Prima facie may be used as an adjective meaning sufficient to establish a fact or raise a presumption unless it is disproved or rebutted. It may also be used on appearance but subject to further evidence or information. Basically just means on its face. So going back to the burden. So you don't have to necessarily prove it, but you have to then, you still have to provide, there was a responsibility that the defendant has to provide enough evidence to say, yes, this was self-defense. So again, you don't put all of it on the prosecution in federal cases. The defendant has the burden of production. And there's interesting, defense claim is brought in response to a felon in possession charge, the 3rd, 9th, and 11th circuits has held that the defendant carries the burden of production and proof. So if you're saying, you know, you're a felon in possession, in certain circuits, you are also required to not just produce the evidence, you also have the burden of proof against you. So there are some differing standards, I guess, in different circuits as the way some of the requirements of the law have. What evidence of a victim? Blah, 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 blah. We're not going to talk about that. Battered spouses syndrome. When the battered spouse syndrome is not well received under federal law, syndrome can be the basis of support for underlying justification defense, duress, or self-defense. Burden, see the elements of self-defense or duress. So that's basically the same thing as either. Let's see. Here's an interesting thing. While under federal guidelines, you know, you have to, if you're defending yourself in some areas, you have to claim self-defense and you only have the burden of production. But under the federal rules, under the defense of others, so defense of others is affirmative defense for murder, voluntary manslaughter, and assault. A person may use a reasonable amount of force in defending against an attack without being guilty of an assault. The right to defend a victim from attack does not exceed the victim's ability to defend themselves. Who is the burden of proof in defense of others? The burden of production and proof is on the defendant. So the defendant raises the affirmative defense that I was doing an act of self-defense. The defense then has to provide the evidence and has the burden of proof to say that, hey, this was the reason why I had to, you know, if you're charging me with murder of this person, I killed that person because I was going to kill somebody else. So I prevented somebody else from dying by killing that person. And I then have to prove as the defense that I was the individual, that was true, that it's a factual and true statement. And I have to prove it just a preponderance standard. Let's see. The government's conduct that prevents access to possible witnesses who can corroborate the defense of another theory may result in dismissal of the indictment. Trial considerations, jury instructions. There must be sufficient evidence to support a defense of others during instruction. Evidence. The defendant's claim of defending others can be undermined by events preceding the criminal act. A defendant's rationale justifying a criminal act while supporting an accused theory of defense of others can provide evidence of an element of the offense and negate the theory of defense in light of the defense. Let's see, defense of property. If you're defending property, when if an individual's lawful possession of property is threatened by unlawful conduct, the individual may take reasonable steps, including use of force, to prevent or terminate the interference of the property. Who does the burden of proof belong to? In federal court, the burden of proof belongs to the defendant. Entrapment. Entrapment is an affirmative defense designed to ensure that persons not be held criminally liable for acts in which they were induced to commit. Blah, blah, blah. I think anybody knows about entrapment. We've heard it a lot. Burden. The defendant bears the burden of production to raise the entrapment defense. The defendant must make a prima facie case, though production of evidence that government's conduct created a substantial risk of entrapment. If this burden is met, the defendant is entitled to a jury instruction, and the burden shifts then to the government to prove beyond reasonable doubt that the defendant was predisposed to commit the criminal act. So again, this is a case where there is a requirement on the defense to bring enough evidence to support a prima facie case. Then at that point, the prosecution has to prove beyond reasonable doubt, which is less, which still shifts some of the burden on the prosecution, but not as much as these state laws do. Withdrawal. So the defendant can contest the intent element required for a conspiracy if there is evidence that he withdrew from the conspiracy. So if there is some conspiracy going on and the person's like, you know what, I got myself out of it. I no longer wanted to have anything to do with it. The defense requires that the defendant show that he affirmatively took actions inconsistent with the object of the enterprise and communicated his intent to withdraw in a manner reasonably calculated to reach his cohorts. So basically said, look, y'all do this. I'm out. I'm done. The defendant's actions or statements supporting withdrawal defense must be of the defendant's volition. And the burden of proof providing the affirmative act of withdrawal is on who but the defense. Abandonment. Abandonment, renunciation, or withdrawal. Criminal attempt occurs when the individual voluntarily forsakes his or her criminal plan prior to committing an overt act in furtherance of the plan. Let's see. Blah, blah, blah. Fifth and Ninth Circuit has rejected this defense because the defendant withdraws before the forming the necessary. Blah, 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 blah. So the First, Second, and Third, 11th have acknowledged. So some courts acknowledge it. They don't really go into burden of proof for abandonment. A defense of voluntary intoxication can only be asserted when a specific intent of an element is of the crime is charged. Evidence of disease, intoxication, or trauma is proper for consideration by the jury to determine whether there's a sufficient degree of intoxication existed to negate intent. The burden of proving specific intent beyond reasonable doubt is on the government. However, the defendant bears the burden of production. Again, a situation where they're even though the government has the burden of proof, for beyond reasonable doubt, there is still a responsibility on the part of the defense to be able to raise some issues. Statutory defense. I'm not going to deal with statutory offenses. Blah, 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 blah. Let's keep on going. There's a lot of information for that one. Okay, so that's basically a bunch of the statutory defenses. Let's just say, for example, determining whether an exception is an affirmative defense or an element of defense depends on the statute. So let's say, 18 U.S.C. 922-0, subsection 1 prohibits unlawful possession of a machine gun, but contains exceptions in subsection 2 for lawful possession prior to the statute's effective date, which have been construed as an affirmative defense. So somebody wants to say, oh, he has a machine gun. That is against the law for you to have a machine gun, right? But if I can say, well, I bought this machine gun, here's the receipt that I bought this machine gun prior to the date when you made it illegal, then that's an affirmative defense. Now, again, it is ridiculous to suggest that the government should be required to prove that I didn't buy it before the date. How would they be able to do so? It's ridiculous. If I'm going to say, all they have to do is prove that I have the gun. Now, I could say, yes, I have the gun, and here's the receipt showing that I bought the gun in a lawful way, then that's an affirmative defense, and it's the responsibility of me to prove that affirmative defense. Let's see. The burden of the government is the element. If it is an element of the defense, the burden of the proof is on the defense if it's the exception. So that's what it says. So normally, if the offense is you have a machine gun, the burden of proof is on the government to prove that I have the unlawful machine gun. However, if I'm saying I'm the exception, I get to say, here's my receipt showing that I bought it. And that now the burden of proof is on me to provide that receipt. I can't just say I bought it on such and such a date that's prior to it becoming illegal for me to have this gun. And then it would be ridiculous for the court to then say, well, he said he bought it beforehand. Prove that he didn't buy it beforehand. That's why you have to have affirmative defenses operate in that way. This is why you have to have affirmative defenses have some requirements on the defense, either if it's a burden of production or if it's burden of proof beyond, not clear and concise, but preponderance standard. I have to prove with the preponderance of the evidence that it is more likely than not that I bought this gun prior to. Now, maybe I don't have the receipt for the machine gun case. Maybe I have pictures of me or videos of me with this gun before that day. So this picture was taken on such and such a date. And maybe I have a shirt that says, this shirt was available this particular year. Or maybe I was at a particular event that was timed. Or maybe there was a timestamp on the camera that says, hey, you took this picture and it was this such and such, date. And so this is evidence, by preponderance standard that I had this gun prior to the date where buying this gun became illegal. Again, but it's my responsibility to prove that in court because that's how affirmative defenses are supposed to work. Yes, the prosecution, and yeah, there is Photoshop, sure, and then that could be debated. But the prosecution has to prove it's a machine gun. And the prosecution has to prove that I own an unlawful weapon, a weapon that's normally considered unlawful. And if they can do that, then they can get me convicted unless I raise the affirmative defense. But if I raise the affirmative defense, it's not the prosecution's job to disprove my affirmative defense in that case. It is my job to provide the evidence to show that by preponderance of the evidence that I am legally possessing this weapon because I fit the exception. But the prosecution might not have the – Daily News says the prosecution has to prove the picture of you holding a machine gun. You might not have access to the picture of me holding the machine gun. All the prosecution needs to convict me is me possessing an illegal weapon because generally speaking, it's against the law for me to have that illegal weapon. But if I'm going to say, hey, I bought that weapon when it was legal to do so, so therefore I qualify for the exemption of the law. The people who support what the affirmative defense has become in these states, like Georgia and Wisconsin, would be arguing that, well, now it's the responsibility of the prosecution to disprove that claim. Well, why then wouldn't anybody say, oh, I bought this gun before it was legal? How do you, if you don't have access to where you bought it, you know, it's not my job to tell, hey, this is where I bought this gun. They have to do that research. But, you know, if they can't find in the research the bill is where it was purchased, guess what? It doesn't matter. They don't have to prove where it's purchased because all they have to do is prove that I have the gun. But because of the affirmative defense standard that is for these types of laws, if I say, yes, I admit it, I own this gun, and I own it legally because I fit the exception, it is my responsibility to prove the exception. And it is a logical fallacy. It is illogical and ridiculous and absurd to suggest that the prosecution would have to disprove my statement. I'm not saying that the prosecution would use the picture as evidence. I'm saying that the defense would use it as evidence. Now, the prosecution could try and fight that. The prosecution could try and say, well, we believe this is Photoshop, so we're going to have this image, let's say I had an image of the receipt. Let's say I didn't have the hard copy of the receipt. Let's say I scanned in the receipt. Now, I provide this scanned copy of the receipt to as evidence showing. Now, the prosecution could say, well, we want to test that image to see if it was Photoshopped. And they could do that. And they could say, hey, this is a Photoshopped image. This is not a legitimate receipt. This is not a legitimate proof. And they can call into question the proof that I bring up. And whether or not it meets the preponderance standard or not is whatever. You know, if the jury believes that it's a fake, then the jury is going to convict me for owning an illegal firearm, illegal weapon. But it's still my responsibility to prove my case if I am using an affirmative defense. And that's my point. It is my responsibility in all of these cases that I just talked about. And this is not me pulling this stuff out of my butt. This is me reading from a document that is explaining federal procedure when it comes to affirmative defenses. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff in this document too. But this section of the law talks about affirmative defenses and how and who the burden of proof rests on when it comes to those affirmative defenses. The burden of proof resides with the defense in many of these cases, in most of these cases. And in some cases, it's just the burden of production of evidence so that the defense has to show enough evidence to make it on its face to say, okay, here's this is a case of self-defense. This is not a case where it wasn't self. This is not a normal case. But that's why I believe that these changes that are being made in the state laws are problematic, because it used to be that the rules were like this in the states too. The states would say, you know, hey, you know, if you are raising an affirmative defense, and then they still do in many cases, especially in civil cases, there are a lot of civil examples that you can use where somebody says, hey, like if somebody was not bringing me under charges, like a crime of thievery, if I'm not being charged with theft of their item, but I'm still being sued in court for, you know, having the watch that there was theirs. Now, they could sue me in court for having the watch, but, you know, I could say, well, you sold me the watch. I don't have to say anything. Well, I could just say, prove I have the watch. But I could wear the watch to court and say, look, this is the watch, and here's the receipt. Here's the canceled check where I bought the watch from you. That's an affirmative defense. And the responsibility of the person raising the affirmative defense is the person making the affirmative defense. Only in these self-defense laws in state courts do we see the responsibility of proving. You don't see that you're seeing a change to where the defense no longer has to prove the affirmative defense. the defense has to disprove, or the prosecution has to disprove the affirmative defense. And again, just as it's ridiculous to suggest that the prosecution should have to disprove that I own that gun, you know, illegally, that legally, like I say, hey, I bought this gun on January 1st, 19, whatever, where it was still legal for me to buy that gun. So it's ridiculous to say, hey, that person didn't, and try to say prosecution has to then say, well, he didn't, and then try and prove that he didn't. No, you have to, the person raising the affirmative defense has to prove that he did. And once that happens, then it's an affirmative defense and accepted by the court. So the fact that we've changed that here, where like federal law, I mean, federal law and state courts are clearly, yeah, they're two different things. You have different procedures in state courts and federal courts, and it's understandable. But, you know, people say, well, what happened to innocent until proven guilty? Every time I talk about this, every time I talk about how we've changed how we handle affirmative defenses, people are always like, well, what about the presumption of innocence? What about it? You still have it. If they can prove that you killed somebody, then they could prove that you killed somebody. But just like in federal court here, if you're claiming self-defense, you have the burden of production, but not of proof, while asserting a self-defense claim. Again, while a self-defense claim is brought in response to it, whatever, you know, that's fine. But you have to bring the evidence to show in and of itself that this is, that on its face, that this is a self-defense case. You have to provide evidence that this is self-defense, period. And it's reasonable to expect that if you're going to say, yeah, I did it, but here's why me doing it is legal, that you should have to say, here why me doing it is legal. You shouldn't just be able to say, yeah, I did it, but it was self-defense, and then require the state to now have to disprove self-defense. No, there should be some requirement on the defense to establish a self-defense claim. And that we've moved away from that has made it much easier now for people to get away with murder. It's how George Zimmerman got away with murder. It's how I believe Kyle Rittenhouse got away with murder. And a lot of other people are going to get away with murder too because of it, because we have taken the onus off of the self-defense claims from the defense. We have told the defense all they have to do is say self-defense, and then it all gets thrown on the prosecution. And while I agree with the general principle that it's better for 100 guilty people to go free than one innocent person to be locked up, I don't believe that we should be tying the hands of the prosecution so much that you are forcing them to prove a negative. Because when you start forcing prosecutions to prove a negative, you start making it impossible for them to do their jobs. And while their jobs should be to seek justice, and there unfortunately there are too many cases where you do see prosecutions trying to make a career for themselves instead of trying to, you know, just seek the truth. You know, there are times where people were, you know, the Duke LaCrosse rape case, for example, that attorney was trying to have a career case and ignored evidence and, you know, just had blinders on and was just trying to make it his importance. What was important to him seemed to be getting a conviction, not seeking the truth. The prosecution should be always trying to seek the truth. And I have a big problem with prosecutors who are just trying to make career cases for themselves. You should make a career case for yourself like the district attorney, like the attorney did who in the prosecution there down in Georgia, because she was spot on. She was excellent. She did a great job prosecuting that case. I mean, it's my opinion, and I've tweeted this out, that if she would have been the district attorney over in Wisconsin, that she might have been able to get a conviction of Kyle Rittenhouse. Maybe, maybe not. I think she's far more competent than Binger was. But at the end of the day, you know, she was even able to overcome the hurdle of the requirements of self-defense because just the evidence was so overwhelming in this case that the McMichaels and Brian were guilty that she could overcome that and she could disprove the self-defense. But there are going to be cases where people were not acting in self-defense, but were putting the onus on the prosecution makes it so that it's difficult or near impossible for them to prove murder, what really was murder. And that's my point with this. So if you agree or disagree, you need to leave a comment down in the YouTube section below. If you can like, share this video. I've been recording this last part. I might make this into a standalone video about affirmative defenses, or I might just make a new one. I don't know. But, you know, at the end of the day, I really think that we would be better off if we did go ahead and go back to how affirmative defenses were. Now, look, I'm open to arguments as to why we needed to move it this way. But I fear that the reason that we moved this way, the reason that we changed the laws, was because of ALEC, the conservative group that likes to create model legislation that is very pro-conservative. And I'm concerned that the reason that they made these rules was to protect certain groups of people and to be able to make it harder for people to be prosecuted and convicted of crimes that they should be convicted of, because the actions that they're doing should cause guilty convictions but are not, because you've set the burden so high and you've made it so impossible to convict these people that they can just get away with murder. And that is not justice. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and where's show end? Looking for the show end. There we go. I'm going to go ahead and end this episode of Liberal Dan Radio, Talk from the Left. That's right. We will be back next Wednesday, 8 p.m. Central, blogtalkradio.com/Liberal Dan and youtube.com/Liberal Dan Radio. Remember to like this video, subscribe to the channel, tell your friends about it, support the Patreon. Follow me on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, etc. Until next week, this is Dan Zimmerman with Liberal Dan Radio. Talk from the left. That's right.